When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Song Facts Podcast. I am your host, Corey O'Flanagan. Thank you so much for being here with me. I hope you're having a fantastic day. If you want to take a minute and go leave us a nice 5-star review, write a message, let us know how we're doing, we would truly appreciate that. And as always, the show is proudly a part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Now imagine chasing your dreams in your early 20s, only to have things not work out as you may have hoped at the time. So you abandon all of that and for 30 years live a completely different life, until all of a sudden a different generation of people discover your talents and give your dream a resurgence. Well, this is the story of today's guest, the inspiring and talented Vashti Bunyan. Tune in as I chat with Vashti about her songs and career, and be sure to check out her book, Wayward, Just Another Life to Live, which is currently available. I just love her music, and I'm so happy to have had a chance to chat with her about her incredible story. So please welcome Vashti Bunyan.
When you say that you're in love with me, do you really know what you mean? Or are you saying it because you've heard of it, or because of something you've seen? Oh, don't believe that love brings happiness.
Well, Vashti Bunyan, thank you so much for coming onto the Song Facts Podcast. First thing that I wanted to say to you was, I'm driving around yesterday. My wife and I just are buying a house and in the process of like getting some stuff done and moving. And as we were kind of making some trips back and forth yesterday, we were listening to your lovely music. And I just want to say that I think that the thing that came into my head is that your voice is just perfectly pairs with a violin and a cello. Like, it's just unbelievable to me. Oh. I just absolutely love it with those two instruments.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love singing to them. Yeah.
Has that always been the case? Like string instruments? Have you ever played on, like messed with the piano? I mean, I hear a lot of guitar and that kind of stuff, but not too many other things.
No, I mostly just play guitar. And when I was recording, I could pretend to play the piano with one finger at a time and then track it. So in that way, I have used the piano, or at least a fake piano. I would love to be able to play it properly, but I don't. I can only play the guitar. I did have violin lessons when I was very young, but my teacher made me play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star for a whole school term. I stopped that. Nah, no more violin. So, yeah.
Okay, so you got a little burnt out, and that makes sense to me, because I took some piano lessons a few years ago, and it was around Christmas time that I was doing the first couple of lessons, and it was all just like do, and I was like, okay, I've got to go a little bit beyond this.
Yes, you're not poor.
So this has been such an interesting interview for me to prepare for, just because I didn't have any knowledge of you. And I'm so happy that I do now, because I just love your music and your voice. It really just fits with like a style of music that resonates with me for whatever reason. I like folky, like really well-written, well-sung music. And your journey is just incredible as I get to learn about you. So I'd like to kind of go back to the early 60s a little bit.
Okay.
Where it sounds like you were in art school and you got ejected from art school because you wanted to just write music rather than draw and paint, which I find pretty interesting. It seems like an art school would be open to any sort of artistic expression. I'm curious about how that experience might have shaped you a little bit.
Oh, sure. I think because it was the kind of art school I was at. It was in a museum in Oxford. It wasn't part of the university, but it was in Oxford, in an old building, and a very traditional art school. And I was thrown out after 2 years because I really preferred to be playing my guitar and writing songs and all kinds of other things that went to do with drawing and painting. And when I said to the principal of the art school, I thought that art was art in any medium. And he said, well, you go and do your art somewhere else. Yeah, you paint and draw. And so I had to leave, but I'm really glad that I was able to leave. You know, I wasn't interested in painting and drawing, although I could do it, and I had always loved it when I was a child, really, but it wasn't my ambition. And I found much more joy in playing guitar and writing songs. And that was in 1963-64.
And then did you go from there to just kind of like getting into an open mic scene? Like, what kind of stuff were you doing after you got out of school?
I went to New York to visit my sister, who still lives there. And I found the Freewheeling Bob Dylan in a record store. And that set me on the thought that I really want to be a musician. I really want to be a traveling musician. I mean, those songs on that album just really opened my mind to...
Yep.
The world that I hadn't seen yet, because I was too young, I was too sheltered, whatever. But that album really educated me in a way.
Same, and very much the same.
Really.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
just incredible. And I came back to London and went round knocking on doors, trying to find myself a manager or an agent or anybody who would listen to me and my songs and try and help me to record. I wanted to make records. And I wasn't very successful because I wasn't dressed in ball gowns and sequins with my hair up. I was in an old holy jumper with an old guitar song over my back. And I didn't make any impression at all on the old guard.
Well, maybe a little bit, because it sounds like you got introduced to Andrew Oldham, who was the Rolling Stones manager. And then it sounds like Keith Richards and Mick Jagger had a song that they were scrapping and you got to record. Is that right?
I don't know if they were. Maybe they were scrapping it. I don't know. But yeah, Andrew gave me this song, Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind.
Why does the sky turn gray every night?
For my first single, and I was outraged. I didn't want to sing somebody else's songs, even if it was Keith Richard, but I did it anyway, and it was the most extraordinary experience. One of my own songs was on the B-side, and it was incredible to be amongst young people taking over, you know, because all the people that I'd been knocking on the doors of were the old guard, the old people, the old impresarios, you know, and to be amongst people like Andrew Oldham and the Stones and the young musicians who were playing the arrangements, was just a wonderful feeling that things were changing. Things were really, really changing, and the young were making themselves felt. It was great, really good.
Well, it was really amazing for me to kind of hear that and just kind of get the idea of, like, you get whatever it's called, ejected or let go from art school. You kind of go on this self-discovery journey, figuring out what it is that you want to do and who you're going to be. You get to record a couple of these songs, and you said it in passing, but I want to talk about one of these songs, because The name of it, I believe, is Train Song. Is that right? That yes. was on the B-side? Okay. And this song is just...
It wasn't. No, that was the next one. A year later, I left Andrew, his wonderful orchestrations and his incredible life force. because it didn't work. That single didn't work. It didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a Canadian producer called Peter Snell, who recorded Train Song with me, with just a cello and a double bass and two guitars. Mm. And that was what I really wanted to do. So yes, that was Train Song. And that was a year later, put out on Columbia, and nobody played it. But anyway, what were you going to say about it?
Well, what I was going to say is, like, we're going to get into like this resurgence that you've had since the early 2000s. But
okay.
This song, Train Song, which, just a little quick stat I'm not sure you're aware of, currently has almost 18 million streams on Spotify, which just for someone who didn't sell when it first came out, that's got to just be an incredible thing to think about. And you've given a little bit of the story. I'd like you to go a little bit more in depth. Like, did you write this a while ago? Did you write it for this recording session? What's the story behind this one?
When I find you, call out your name, love. Don't be surprised. It's so many months and so long since I've met you. Don't even know what I'll find when I get to you. But suddenly now, I know where I belong. It's many hundred miles and it won't be long. It won't be long. It won't be long.
Well, that was when I was still at art school, and a friend that I shared a bedsit with had a guitar, and we started writing songs together. We wrote a song together called 17 Pink Sugar Elephants. And later on, I met a poet called Alistair Clare in Oxford, who had this lovely song called Train Song, but he didn't have any music for it. And I put the 17 Pink Sugar Elephants tune to his words for Train Song. And so my friend Jenny and I share the royalties for Train Song. And Alistair, actually Alistair is no longer with us, but his nephew gets the royalties for the words. And I just love that. I love that it has been something that has grown despite none of us doing anything for it. You know, it was released in 1966. And yeah. My friend Jenny and Alistair and I have been just, it's not just the royalties, but it's the recognition of that song that has been so extraordinary for all of us. Just and it's been used in adverts, it's been used in film scores, you know, it's just, it's grown without me having to do anything for it at all.
Yeah.
Just remember it and remember the session. I remember how incredible it was to be just recording a song simply, and that it has worked all these years later is lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the resurgence of these things and how they filter through, I mean, good art is going to find a way to people who are looking for it. And I think that your tale is a testament to that, because there's a lot of, this kind of leads nicely into my next question, the next song I want to talk about, because there's a lot of, if you search for you online, there's so many people that are even now discovering your music and being very impacted by that. And I imagine at the time of your life that you're at now, this has to be an amazing feeling of stuff that's, whatever, 50, 60 years old for you, incredibly.
Yes.
And so the next song that I wanted to talk about, and I think the one that I resonate most with that I've heard so far is I'd Like to Walk Around in Your Mind.
Walk all over the things you say to me. I'd like to run and jump on your solitude. I'd like to rearrange your attitude to me. You say you just want peace and to never hurt anyone.
And I think it's because, just lyrically, I think that it can kind of take whoever's listening to it on a journey, and it can be interpreted in many different ways. But I did find someone discussing it online, and I was curious to bring this to your attention and see what your thoughts were. They said, "I really like the line, 'I'd like to run and jump on your solitude.'" And they said that this is just such a sweet line to me. The person is sad and alone, and the speaker wants to crash in on their unhappy state and wake them up and help them have fun again. And I am just curious if this listener had some insight into where your head was at the time as you wrote this.
I think it was frustration with somebody who just wasn't going to take any risks, or another line is, you see the end before the beginning has ever begun. It was so frustrating that he wouldn't. I mean, this is about a real person. It wasn't just a made up person. It's about a real person who would not take any risks with commitment. I suppose in today's language, it would be that he was a commitment phobe. But then it was just frustrating that he wouldn't take life on, wouldn't take any risks. And I'd like to run and jump on your solitude. He just wanted to be left alone, poor guy. And I want,
so not even like someone who is like an, I go to like a romantic type relationship where you're like, no, like, let's try this as us, and this person's like, I don't want to settle down into a relationship. I'm either happy on my own, or I just want to, like, you know, be with this person this time and this person this time and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. Well, not so much that last bit, but yeah, just generally he didn't want to be part of a couple. He wasn't ready for that. And I was. I really liked him, and I really wanted to be with him, but he was not in that place. And for me, it was frustrating because I thought we could be so great. And he just wasn't having it at all.
Yeah.
He wanted to be solitary. Poor guy. Why couldn't I just leave him alone?
That's another good way to spin it. Yeah. But then you just go ahead and write this beautiful song about it, which I certainly appreciate. When was that song written? Was that written around the same time in the mid to late 60s?
66, yes. Yeah, 66 into 60s. No, end of 66 it would have been. Yeah, and I recorded it in 67, but it never came out.
Stay tuned for more Song Facts Podcast right after this.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Get your song facts back. So I wanted you to chat a little bit about, I got just like a blurb of this, but I'm curious about this story of you going on like, is it a horse and carriage and going up from somewhere in England and making your way up to the Isle of Skye?
Yep.
Okay, so I got to understand this. Like, there's vehicles at this time. This was a choice.
It was
you
a choice.
Just I'm like, is this someone just trying to slow down? Like the way of living was just too fast for them, and it's like I just need to like go on this journey. I'm so curious about this time.
Well, well, my first single with Andrew Oldham didn't work. My second single, Train Song, didn't work. Nobody heard it. And then I made more. I made I'd Like to Walk Around in Your Mind. And I thought that was going to be it because I loved the recording. I loved everything about that song, but it was never released. And mm-hmm. a couple of other things like Winter is Blue and Coldest Night of the Year, those were all not released properly. And I became just totally disillusioned with the whole thing. I thought, oh, well, I must be no good. And I met this art student who was living in a wood behind his art college under a rhododendron bush. And I went to join him under a rhododendron bush. And we got thrown out of that wood. And on the way out, we decided what we really needed was a house on wheels that we couldn't get thrown out of. And we could go wherever we wanted. And then, but we'd need a horse because horses don't need petrol. And we didn't have any money for petrol. So we thought, a horse and a cart, that would do it. And by some incredible miracle, that time that we were thrown out of the wood with all our possessions and a friend came to pick us up, we found a little wagon and a horse on the way back, that being thrown out of the wood. We found a horse and a wagon. And at that time we met, a friend had a friend called Donovan Leach, who was a singer. And he had just bought some land on the Isle of Skye that he wanted to sympathetic people, artists and painters and writers and everything, not as a commune, but just to have those people on his land. And that sounded like a very good idea to us. And he went up in his Land Rover. We went up with a horse and cart, and it took us a year and a half. And it hadn't occurred to us that it would take that long. But it was an incredible journey to just leave everything behind. I didn't want to be a singer anymore. I didn't want to be anything anymore. I just wanted to get to where we were going. And I don't know, I actually can't remember what was in my head at the time. I think probably not very much.
I mean, that's kind of the beauty of youth, right? I think it's an amazing, like, there's so many people now that have gravitated towards like van life and getting rid of having to pay rent and do anything like that and just living out of this very small space. And that's, you were kind of like the original connoisseur of it, but just doing it in a much different way, which I just absolutely love. I'm endlessly fascinated by this.
It was partly just out of necessity because neither of us had any money. Neither of us had family who were supporting us. And it just seemed like the only thing that we could do, really. And it wasn't like it was a conscious decision or any kind of statement or any rebellion or anything like that. It was just what we did.
Just taking a journey for the sake of taking a journey.
Because we had a destination in mind, the north of Scotland. Well, you know, northwest of Scotland, the Isle of Skye, from south of London all the way up to the Isle of Skye. And it took us a year and a half, and it was the most incredible education for me, for my dog. It was a fantastic journey. And I wrote songs along the way without thinking of recording them. I never wanted to set my foot in a studio again ever. But I did write songs, and it was to keep us going mostly, you know, not to not with the thought of making an album or anything like that. I just wanted to keep our spirits up, really, because it was quite hard.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, did you feel like the songs that you were writing during that part of your life were different because you relieve yourself of the pressure of these might see the day of light in a studio someday?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure that led to them being very different. But also my partner at the time said, why don't you stop writing these miserable little love songs and write about the wonderful world around you? And that's kind of what I did.
And so what went on after this then? So you do that, and then for me, there's, and I'm sure that one of the reasons that we're talking here is you have this this book that came out last year that's now getting released in America called Wayward, Just Another Life to Live. And I'm curious, what's this, for people that are listening who haven't read the book and may not know your story, in the early 2000s, some folk musicians, just people in the music industry, rediscovered your music, and it had this massive resurgence where within a couple of years of that, you're now out playing live, you're recording more songs that you're writing, like just this incredible thing that must have, I don't know, must have felt like it came out of nowhere for you. I'm curious about that, this 30-year gap.
Right.
What was going on?
Well, well, you might well ask. I don't know what was going on. I halfway through the journey, I met Joe Boyd, the producer, Joe Boyd, and he wanted to make an album of the songs. And he persuaded me back to the studio. And we made an album called Just Another Diamond Day, which was never really properly released. It sort of came out in 1970, but it was totally ignored. Nobody spoke about it. Nobody I knew spoke about it. I didn't like it myself. I thought it was too folky, too fey, too gentle. And I abandoned it completely for 30 years. I went,
wow.
I just lived my life. I had my kids and we lived in an extraordinary life, but with no music in it whatsoever. I didn't even sing to my kids. Music was something that I'd thrown out of my life. But
incredible.
In the year 2000, the album was reissued to a completely different response, a totally different generation who understood it in the way that my contemporaries never had. That this time I could read lovely things said about it. And it was an extraordinary experience for me to have people say good things about my music, because nothing had ever been said about it. And so getting onto the internet and finding out that actually this stuff still exists, you know, I thought it was completely forgotten. And then with the reissue, I don't know, it unlocked something. I was able to pick up my guitar without it sounding sad to me.
Yeah.
And I started writing songs again. And yeah, I made two more albums. And yes, there was that huge gap of the 30 years without any music in it. And then suddenly, a lot of music, a lot of people, a lot of new musical friends that I had never had before. I never played with anybody before in my old life, of my old music life. I never played with other musicians really, or had anything much to do with other musicians. I didn't know them. And to come to this totally different time where I met lots of wonderful musicians and collaborated with people that I would never have dreamed of doing. And wow, how different.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an incredible thing. I mean, that's what I didn't know, is that I kind of thought so because I couldn't find any information about those 30 years. But I was like, it seems like she just completely left this life that she'd been living behind.
Yeah.
And then found it again, which I just think is a huge testament. And like it's a good way for people to learn. I think as we get older, we tend to not try new things as much. And although this wasn't trying something new, essentially it was, because it had been 30 years. That's a whole nother lifetime. That's multiple lifetimes, really. And
absolutely. I didn't do any live performance when I was young, and then suddenly I was being asked to do stuff on the stage. Oh my God. But it was great. And I'm so lucky to have that second go at it.
Did you feel nervous at all? Because did you look back on your time in the mid-60s, early 70s doing music as a failure and a part of your life, and that you were like, I don't want to revisit that, though I don't have good memories from that? Or was it something that you were open to?
Well, I think in the few weeks before the reissue of Diamond Day, I was terrified that it was going to be the same thing, nursery rhymes, you know. But it was so different. And yes, I was very scared. I was very scared, but I didn't need to be, because the response to it was just, well, it was magical, really. Slightly surreal.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, to be revisiting something that I had left behind so long ago. And the first stage performance, yes, I was shaking. But yeah, how lucky I am.
So then where did the idea for Wayward, Just Another Life to Live, where did this come from? Was this just you just saying, you know what, I've got a story to tell and I want to put it out there?
Yes, I started it years and years and years ago as a way of trying to explain to my children what their parents had been like and what their lives had been like before they came along, and the reasons for it, or, you know, trying to figure it out for myself, really. But it wasn't until lockdown that a friend called me and he said, so what are you doing? And I said, oh, what am I doing? Oh my goodness. Oh, I'm writing. And it was a complete lie. I wasn't. And he said, oh, I know somebody who would be very interested to read what you're writing. And that was Lee Braxton of White Rabbit, who I did send him some of what I'd written. And he signed me up to White Rabbit, and I wrote the rest over the rest of lockdown, in fact. And thank goodness I had the time, for not the best of reasons, but I did have to actually make myself finish what I'd started all those years before. And it was cool.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, sometimes you have to like that lie that you told your friend, sometimes we have to do things like that in order to get the motivation that we need. Because now it became real, and you're like, now I kind of have this accountability, so I've got to put something down.
I've got to do it.
I'm happy that you did.
Thank you. Yeah, it was there. I did enjoy writing it, but I did still have in mind wanting to tell my kids what it had all been about, and try to describe to them the kind of life that I had before they came along, and explain to them a few of that. I mean, I did carry on with that kind of life, the Diamond Day kind of life, out in the country with all kinds of animals and people and kids. I did carry on with it, and that's how they grew up. But I wanted to explain to them how it had started. Excuse me. And I think that has worked. They now know.
Yeah.
They now know all the stuff that I did that I never mentioned to them about the earth.
Well, I'm really happy for that. And I mean, not a better reason than anyway to just kind of tell your story to your children. I think that's really great. I only have one more question for you, and it's kind of a reflective question, but since you've had this really unique career and this really unique perspective now that you're kind of on the tail end of it, and I'm curious, when you look back at your life and career now, What knowledge would you share with your younger self when you were making some of these pivotal decisions that you made in the 60s and 70s?
What would I share with myself to? I think one of my big problems when I was very young and first starting with music was that I would compare myself to other people and find myself wanting. And I think what I would say, looking back now and seeing what has happened, is that everybody is so different and that you have to celebrate that difference really and keep going with it and not feel that you're not as good as another person or you can't do this or you can't do that, that you do what you do and you go with it. And I just wish that I had had a little bit more faith in myself and in my own music. Could have done with the internet back then.
Virality is a real thing.
Well, there was no feedback, you know, there was nowhere I could go to find out if it was any good or not. And so I would love to be able to tell that young woman, it's okay. You've done something that's okay. And you don't need to feel bad about it. That's what I'd like to say to her.
I think that that's as good a thing as any. And I mean, I think the thing that it kind of relates to is because of what happened in the early 2000s with you putting this other album out and the resonating that it had, mm-hmm. just try. As long as you tried, you can't really fail. The failure would be just not trying. That's always the perspective I've taken on is like, well, I gave it my best shot. So if it didn't resonate with people, that's nothing I can do about that. I can't change how they are. All I can do is be me and just try to continue to be me in whatever moment that we have right now. And I think that that's amazing. Vashti Bunyan, I can't thank you enough. This has been lovely. I don't want to take up too much of your time. So and I'm so grateful to have discovered your music. We have a nice couple hour drive up to the mountains and we're going to put it on and just enjoy the rest of our day with it. And thank you so much for your music and your story and your time.
Thank you. It's been lovely to talk to you and I hope you have a great time out in the hills.
Thank you so much to Vashti for coming on to the show. Such an incredible story and really just a testament to how keeping your mind open and not closing doors completely behind you can just transpire new things in life at times that we may just never expect. As always, for the stories behind the songs, go to songfacts.com and have a great day. Thank you so much.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.